The most widely adopted concept of portfolio diversification was modern portfolio theory, first developed by Harry Markowitz at the University of Chicago. Bernstein describes the little-noticed birth of this theory.
The most famous insight in the history of modern finance and investment appeared in a short paper titled Portfolio Selection. It was published in the March 1952 issue of the Journal of Finance, the only journal then in existence for scholars in the field. Its author was an unknown 25-year-old graduate student from the University of Chicago named Harry Markowitz. No one, including Markowitz, was aware that his paper would turn out to be a landmark in the history of ideas. Although his achievements would earn him a 1990 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences, the paper languished for nearly 10 years after publication in 1952, attracting fewer than 20 citations in the academic literature until after 1960. The simple title and brevity of the article disguises its extraordinary intellectual density and originality. Only 4 of its 14 pages are straight text without graphs or equations, while 7 graphs on the rest of the pages would readily qualify as the idle doodles of an absent-minded teenager or as designs for an archery target range.
The thrust and conclusions of the article seemed very simple and self-evident.
Despite its formidable appearance, the true meaning of Markowitz's article is homey. It boils down to nothing more than a formal confirmation of 2 old rules for investing. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Markowitz defined these familiar rules with scientific precision. Using mathematics to solve the puzzle of the investor's trade-off, his analysis shows precisely how investors can combine their hopes of realizing the largest possible gain with exposure to the least possible risk.
Markowitz dressed this simple idea in formal language, including mathematical equations, in his 1952 paper and his 1959 book on the topic, both entitled Portfolio Selection. Beginning in the 1960s, the theory produced oceans of articles and books. At the core of the formulas for portfolio risk was a weighted numeric value given to different types of investments. On the low-risk end of the spectrum were short-term U.S. Treasury bills, which were considered to have very low potential for deviating from the expected financial reward. The short-term T-bill, therefore, was said to have the lowest risk and the lowest possibility of unexpected gain. At the other end of the risk spectrum were common stocks, which received a higher numeric weighting because of their higher risk and higher potential return. Between these 2 ends of the spectrum, numeric weightings were assigned to all other investment alternatives, such as corporate bonds, municipal bonds, and foreign stocks. The goal of this method is to build a portfolio that mathematically matches an investor's risk tolerance with his expected reward. Those with little tolerance for risk should concentrate on options with a lower rating. Those with higher risk tolerance will want to concentrate on higher-rated options. Modern portfolio theory doesn't attempt to describe an ideal portfolio for all investors. It merely wants to define a numerical value for the amount of risk in a portfolio. As the concept became more widely discussed and ridiculed, used and misused, understood and misunderstood, it established not only new mathematical techniques, but also a new vocabulary. Words that at first seemed esoteric gradually became part of Wall Street's standard language. And at the core of this vocabulary was the term beta, B-E-T-A, as defined here by Professor Nicholas Apostolou of Louisiana State University.
Beta is a calculation of the volatility of a stock or overall portfolio as compared to a broad market indicator, such as the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index. A beta of 1 for a stock or portfolio means that the stock or portfolio will move in the same proportion and direction as the S&P 500. A beta of 1.5 implies that the price of the stock or the direction of the portfolio will be 50% more volatile than the S&P 500, rising higher than the S&P 500 when the market is climbing, but falling sharper when the market is declining. Thus, the higher the beta, the higher the risk.
The concept of beta, as widely understood in the early 1970s, helped to explain why the go-go money managers of the 1960s had portfolios that surged during the bull market of the late 1960s and then collapsed dramatically during the bear market of the 1970s. The go-go portfolios were high beta, performing spectacularly well during a rising market and extremely poorly during a decline. Modern portfolio theory does not argue against a high-risk portfolio. To the contrary, another important concept of modern portfolio theory was called the capital asset pricing model, which used mathematics to conclude that while high beta portfolios do increase risk, they also increase the potential to achieve better returns than the market as a whole. As many people had instinctively known for years, high-risk portfolios bring higher potential for reward. Now this wisdom was corroborated by mathematical formulas. Many of the mathematical ideas in modern portfolio theory were severely attacked by Wall Street professionals, who perceived a threat to the human and artful skills of money managers. Today, however, few portfolio decisions are made without some nod to the concept of beta and its companion, the capital asset pricing model. And believe it or not, two other related theories surfaced from the academic world in the early 1970s, and these really rattled the professional money management establishment. These two theories are known as the random walk theory and the efficient market theory, and they continue to irritate and provoke money management professionals even today. The random walk and efficient market theories have been discussed in academic circles for years. But when Princeton economics professor Burton Malkiel forcefully proclaimed their details to the investing public in his 1973 book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, much of the financial industry became enraged. Malkiel reported what he said he and his academic peers had found.
The view of most investment managers is that professionals certainly outperform all amateur and casual investors in managing money. Much of the academic community, on the other hand, believes that professionally managed investment portfolios cannot outperform randomly selected portfolios with equivalent risk characteristics. Random walkers claim that the stock market adjusts so quickly and perfectly to new information that amateurs buying at current prices can do just as well as the pros. Thus, the value of professional investment advice is nil, at least insofar as it concerns choosing a stock portfolio.
Armed with performance data, primarily on mutual fund managers, academic critics found that 75% of professionally managed portfolios typically do not even match gains in broad market measurements, such as the Standard & Poor's 500 index. Over a longer period, the professors maintained that once a professional manager's expenses are subtracted, few, if any, consistently beat the market averages. The academics concluded that professional managers are no better than anyone else in picking stocks or beating the market, no matter what education, experience, or amount of work went into the effort. The academics claimed that the reason for this could be found in historical statistics, which show that individual stock prices have a random tendency to go up as well as down. What's more, all of these movements were said to be based on surprises that no one can predict unless they have valid and truly secret insider information. There are as many good surprises to push stock prices up as there are bad surprises to push them down, the academics argued. Moreover, the Random Walk researchers insisted that while professionals can hit on stocks that go up, it's largely due to luck rather than stock-picking skills, which in any event were said to cost enough in fees to offset any advantageous performance. The Random Walkers thus claimed that anyone can have as many successes or failures as a professional, and all without paying a fee. Financial historian Robert Sobel recounts Wall Street's reaction to this charge.
At first, the professionals were incredulous. Were the professors saying that throwing darts at the financial page was as good a method of selecting stocks as any other? The answer was an unqualified yes, and delivered with a blandness and matter-of-fact attitude that infuriated the Wall Streeters and dumbfounded them, too, as the Random Walkers threw in mathematical equations they couldn't comprehend.
The academics argued that prices are random partly because so many people, both amateur and professionals, are researching the same universe of stocks. Therefore, investment information is so widely understood that stock prices fully reflect all known information at any given time. Efficient market theorists also claim that only some surprising bit of new information can significantly change the price. Randomness in pricing is therefore said to result from what is called the efficient market. Professor Malkiel summarizes this basic concept.
According to the efficient market theory, the stock market is so good at adjusting to new information that nothing and no one can predict its future course in a superior manner. Because of the actions of the pros, the prices of individual stocks quickly reflect all the news that is available. Thus, the odds of selecting superior stocks or anticipating the general direction of the market are even. Your guess is as good as that of the ape, your stockbroker, or even mine.
William Sharpe, a Stanford University finance professor and a protege of Harry Markowitz, helped Markowitz create the concept of the capital asset pricing model. He and Markowitz shared the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1990. Sharpe explains the reasoning behind the efficient market theory.
In an efficient market, a security's price will be a good estimate of its investment value. That is, the present value of its further prospects, as estimated by well-informed and clever analysts. Any substantial disparity between price and value would reflect market inefficiency. In a well-developed and free market, major inefficiencies are rare. The reason is not hard to find. Major disparities between price and investment value will be noted by alert analysts, who will seek to take advantage of their discoveries. Securities priced below value will be purchased, creating pressure for price increases due to increased demand to buy. Securities priced above value will be sold, creating pressure for price decreases due to increased supply to sell. As investors seek to exploit opportunities created by temporary inefficiencies, they will cause the inefficiencies to be reduced, denying the less alert and the less informed a chance to obtain large abnormal profits.
In 1976, efficient market enthusiasts got a boost when Benjamin Graham, the father of fundamental security analysis, Warren Buffett's mentor, and a revered investment theorist, gave an interview to Financial Analyst Journal. In this interview, Graham disclaimed his own concepts and embraced the efficient market theory.
I am no longer an advocate of elaborate techniques of security analysis in order to find superior value opportunities. In the old days, any well-trained security analyst could do a good professional job of selecting undervalued issues through detailed studies. But in the light of the enormous amount of research now being carried on, I doubt whether in most cases such extensive efforts will generate superior sections to justify their cost. I'm on the side of the efficient market school of thought.
Followers of the efficient market concept have readily acknowledged that markets are efficient only if a great number of people are actively competing in an effort to beat market averages. This very pursuit is said to be what makes the market efficient. People are said to be naturally competitive, so they will continually try to outperform others, thus assuring that the market will remain efficient. When the concepts of efficient market and random walk first started gaining widespread notice, market professionals shrugged it off. At the time, it was not possible to invest in an index portfolio designed to imitate the overall performance of the market, thus beating 3 out of 4 professionals. In 1971, the first index fund was created. In 1976, an index fund was first offered to the general public by the Vanguard Group of investment companies. All this created a new style of investing called passive investment management. Ironically, it was carried out primarily by professional money managers for pensions and insurance companies. Combining indexed portfolios with the concepts of modern portfolio theory, a passive investment manager would devise an investment plan using different index funds with different risk values to build a portfolio matching a client's risk-reward expectations. No attempt was made to search for specific stocks. John Bogle, founder of the Vanguard Group and an index fund pioneer, describes the development of passive management.
Passive management quickly came to be known as indexing, a designation adopted in 1971 when the concept became reality through its application to the management of actual investment portfolios. Then the broad-based Standard & Poor's stock index, heavily dominated by large blue-chip companies, was chosen as the index standard. At that time, it represented the soundest indicator of stock market returns, comprised a dominant proportion of the stock market's total capitalization, and was relatively easy to replicate. Further, no valid measure of the capitalization of the entire stock market was then available.
Since that index fund was created, many similar funds have been initiated, representing a wide variety of different market segments. Rex Sinkfield, a money manager who uses only index funds, explains how a portfolio is configured by selecting index funds that match asset classes.
Current research looks at 3 dimensions. How much do I want to have exposed to equities? Within equities, how much do I want to have exposed to companies that are really struggling, for example, value stocks? How much to small stocks? The person who wants equities that will earn more than market returns over time and recognizes that it entails above market risk has only 2 avenues to pursue. That's because research shows that value stocks have higher returns than growth stocks and small stocks have higher returns than large stocks. But both value stocks and small stocks are riskier than the market as a whole. And you can go domestically and internationally with both. There are lots of index funds available to do this. Those are the dimensions from which investors must choose.
Today, passive management occupies a growing part of the investment world. Yet the active management camp still dominates the scene. And the debate continues to rage between adherents of these 2 very different approaches. In 1986, Warren Buffett became angry when he learned that the business department at his alma mater, Columbia University, had become controlled by efficient market disciples. Buffett wrote an article for his alumni magazine, which was later printed in Barron's, decrying the situation. The article detailed the performances of many active investment managers who had outperformed the market over a long period of time. Buffett offered his view of the concept of efficient markets.
There is much inefficiency in the market.
Value investors have successfully exploited gaps between price and value. When the price of a stock can be influenced by a herd on Wall Street, with prices set at the margin by the emotional person or the greediest person or the most depressed person, it is hard to argue that the market always prices rationally. In fact, market prices are frequently nonsensical.
Few advocates of efficient market theory and passive management techniques would deny that some active money managers can achieve the results that Warren Buffett and others have delivered over the years. But efficient market people say that such stellar performers are so few in number and represent such a small percentage of people calling themselves money managers that to apply the record of a few to the expected future performance of everyone with a similar job title is not only erroneous, but potentially dangerous. For many supporters of passive management, a key issue is how expenses affect an investor's return. William Sharp explains.
The expected returns from active management are actually less than those for passive management. The fees charged by active managers are typically much higher than those levied by passive managers. The difference averages anywhere from 0.3% to 1% of the manager's assets under management. Further, passively managed portfolios usually experience very small transaction costs, while, depending on the amount of trading involved, active management transaction costs can be quite high. Thus, if active managers, on average, have no information advantage over passive managers, the passive manager will outperform active managers because of cost difference. Passive management thus entails settling for superior as opposed to mediocre results.
Of course, active management professionals see it differently. They point out that promoters of passive management use data based on average returns and expenses for all professional managers, while investors seeking above-average results select managers with above-average records. For many investors, both large and small, the controversy about passive versus active has boiled down to a middle-ground compromise. Some money is earmarked for passively managed index funds, and some money is designated for an actively managed approach, ultimately producing an asset allocation plan that matches one's tolerance for risk. William Sharp concurs.
In a crude way, this strategy may be a reasonable response to the unresolved active-passive debate. Clearly, all assets cannot be passively managed. Who would be left to maintain security prices at fair value levels? On the other hand, investors with above-average investment skill are clearly in the minority of the group currently offering their services to investors.
Some market pundits believe that the increasing use of index investing, which is typically done without judging the value of each stock in the index, in the long term can lead many stocks to be dangerously overpriced. Among those concerned is Paul Samuelson, a Nobel Prize-winning economist who says investors should carefully scrutinize where they put their money. Ironically, if Samuelson's observations prove to be correct, the growing widespread assumption that markets are efficient, along with the ever-widening use of index investing, could lead to greater inefficiencies. And only a sharp-eyed, active approach to investing could hope to catch and exploit them. While investment management professionals battle out their differences with academic theorists, the individual investor, with real-world needs for immediate investment guidance, is often the victim. Many such investors are confused more than ever about the best path to take. Barton Biggs, chairman of Morgan Stanley Asset Management, has observed a maze of different opinions and options over his long career, each seemingly compelling in its own right, and he believes that the overall effect can be crippling.
As the senior executive of an asset management firm, I continually see people who have suddenly assumed the responsibility for supervising serious money. They are bright souls, and they know they need help. Suddenly, in effect, they have become fiduciaries. They have no intention of managing those funds themselves, but after speaking with some brokers, investment management firms, trust departments, and maybe a mutual fund salesman or two, they are confused and lost. Each party advises a solution to the investment process problem that serves his special self-interest. There is literally nowhere to go for impartial judgment and advice.
While it may be disheartening to hear such an observation by a leader in the field of investment management, there obviously are many individual investors with needs ranging from modest to elaborate portfolio management who have enjoyed excellent long-term relationships with their money managers. Virtually every investment professional advises that the best way to find an appropriate money manager is to conduct a methodical search. Unfortunately, few people actually do it. A methodical approach, however, would start with a list of candidates culled from a variety of sources. Broker recommendations can be valuable. Also, most large public libraries have directories of money managers, organized either by professional credentials, such as being a certified financial analyst, or by rating services, such as Nelson's Directory of Investment Managers. Candidates in these directories can be quickly sorted based on geographic convenience or minimum account sizes. When looking for a money manager or financial planner, it's a good idea to know in advance the precise range of advice or service that you will need. This could range from active management of equities only to full management of all your securities and financial needs, including insurance, taxes, and estate planning. There is a money manager to fit every need, but all money managers do not provide all services. After narrowing your list, the next step is to assess each candidate's performance record. Former stockbroker David Case offers this advice to use when looking at a money manager's performance record.
The manager should have a consistent and relatively long track record, for at least 3 years, preferably 5 or 10. But track records can be misleading because they're merely a measure of past years' average performances. Some managers attain good returns for 5 years but need to pass out airbags for the ride along the way. For example, one manager can average a 20% return by making his clients 40% in year one and then 0% the following year. Another manager averages 20% by gaining 18% 1 year and 22% the next. I call this difference in styles the ulcer factor. The less volatility and the higher average return, the fewer ulcers you're likely to get.
Beyond raw performance figures, a money manager's investment approach is a critical aspect of your evaluation. Marshall Loeb, former editor of Fortune and Money magazines, says you should match a money manager's investment style with your own.
Find out an advisor's investment philosophy before making your choice. It should harmonize with your own. A growth manager tries for capital gains by picking companies whose earnings will go up more than the average for their industry. A pursuer of aggressive growth leans toward riskier small capitalization stocks. A conservative growth seeker looks for blue chip stocks. A market timer tries to get you into the market near the bottom of the price cycle and out near the top, while a value investor ignores market trends but buys neglected stocks of well-managed companies and holds them indefinitely. A contrarian takes the same approach but doesn't make long-term commitments to the stocks he buys.
Matching a money manager's style with your own includes an honest appraisal of your own risk tolerance, plus an assessment of which investment style best fits that level of tolerance. Once you are comfortable with a manager's qualifications and investment style, the next important consideration involves fees. Investment expenses can eat away at returns. But remember that fees charged can mean different things to different people. One investor may be concerned solely with bottom-line impact. Others may willingly pay fees for less tangible benefits, such as convenience or close attention to an active account. When all other things are equal or nearly equal, you might choose an investment advisor simply on the basis of your personal comfort level. A money manager may charge an annual fee as low as 0.5% and as high as 3% of assets managed. However, low-price managers tend to be less experienced, perhaps looking to build up a client list. Some inexpensive managers may expect to receive fees or commissions on the financial products they buy for you. Low fees, particularly on small-sized accounts, should be questioned to determine other sources of compensation and to identify potential conflicts of interest. Managers expecting an annual fee of more than 2% should be scrutinized for their potential to produce a high return, or perhaps for a willingness to provide specialized or personalized attention to your account. This applies to all types of managed accounts. The Barron's Guide to Making Investment Decisions offers some words of warning about fees on wrap accounts.
In addition to a typical annual fee of 3%, hidden fees called execution costs can really hammer you. Execution costs include the spreads that managers must deal with when they buy or sell securities. Ordinarily, a money manager shops around to get the best spreads and execution of orders, but when he agrees to participate in a wrap account, the manager often surrenders that privilege, agreeing to funnel all the trades through the sponsoring brokerage firm. Although it doesn't necessarily happen, this lack of transaction choice could sharply increase the manager's costs of trading. Some experts estimate that in a worst-case situation, the execution costs could eat up as much as 10% of a poorly managed portfolio, although 5% would be more likely in a merely bad situation.
A similar piling up of fees could happen with wrap accounts using mutual funds.
When you pay a brokerage firm a wrap account fee for setting you up in mutual funds, every fund the broker puts you into automatically becomes a load fund, upon which you pay an effective sales charge for every dollar you put into a fund. If your broker bows to temptation, he will wind up putting you in funds that pay him a fee for directing new clients to them. The broker wins in these cases, while you are saddled with fees that could range as high as 3%, and that's before the mutual fund's fees are added on.
Less scrupulous money managers may overtrade or churn an account in order to generate more commissions. It may be hard to determine whether your account is being churned. Portfolio turnover may produce superior results, but most experts say that portfolios are most vulnerable to churning when the stock market is rising. This is when few clients look at commissions because they are solely focused on the bottom line return, which can look good in a rising market even after high commissions. Only by carefully examining regular reports can you identify unusual or unexplained patterns of higher trading volume, which may indicate churning. Similarly, the continual monitoring of expenses is but one part of a client's ongoing responsibility to keep the money manager's efforts in line with his or her own needs. Until the 1970s, professional money managers often were not scrutinized for their performance results. Since the 1970s, however, the pendulum has swung the other way, increasing the performance claims used in advertising to a fever pitch. Under the pressure of constant measurement and with keen competition for a client's business, money managers have become pressured to beat the market at every turn, whatever the client's professed investment goals. At the same time, however, managers might take the easiest route by simply staying even with market benchmarks, without regard to the client's fullest potential. Whatever clients may think about their own risk tolerance, money managers often take the brunt when things don't go well at every turn in the market. As money management veteran Martin Fridson puts it,
An experienced money manager knows that you'll appreciate the high-risk, high-reward concept better in a bull market than in a bear market. Just wait until the averages fall and your high-beta holdings fall by an even greater percentage. You may forget that your portfolio is performing exactly as it's supposed to, by outperforming a rising market but underperforming a declining market. You'll probably begin to wonder whether you need a new advisor. In theory, the money manager's correct response is to explain, one more time, in a calm voice, why it's rational for you to tolerate prudent risks. As a practical matter, it's hard to do this when you're screaming at him. Aside from enduring your unpleasant reaction, the investment advisor will probably lose your business.
Fridson says the fear of being fired keeps many managers from achieving the best results for clients.
From the money manager's standpoint, the path of least resistance is to forget about achieving the highest possible returns over the long run. The more important objective, if he doesn't want to get fired, is to avoid doing worse than the market in any period. That means reducing risk below a level that you're perfectly capable of handling.
For a client who is evaluating whether to switch managers, index measurements can be an important point for determining a money manager's effectiveness. Yet Nobel laureate William Sharpe advises caution as you evaluate and consider changing managers.
Unfortunately, it is very difficult to separate performance due to skill from that due to luck. In this context, as in any other, a change should be made only when there is adequate reason to expect the advantages to outweigh the costs. Switching from one manager to another on the basis of minor differences in short-term performance will certainly incur transactions costs as the new manager replaces old holdings with new ones that conform to his or her style. But there may or may not be any improvement in future performance. Differences in managers' past performance should be treated as interesting data, suggesting areas for more detailed examination and discussion. But drastic changes in management based solely on recent history should usually be avoided.
This practical view of human interaction drives home the importance of ensuring that communication is clear. Charles Ellis, past president of the Association for Investment Management and Research, puts it this way.
In setting long-term policy for an investment portfolio, the client and the investment manager need to communicate certain information to each other. The client needs to understand the realistic expectations for each type of investment and each asset class, for both the short-term and the long-term. Clients also need to understand the probable and possible chaotic events that occur within the long-term. In other words, what are the risks? What are the uncertainties? And what are the longer-term average returns achieved in the past? And most important, how may the future differ from the past? Investment managers may indeed know much more than a given client about investing and the capital markets, but they know all too little about the unique needs of each client. Relying on a manager's general knowledge leads to all clients getting the same Procrustean asset mix.
Continuity, communication, and courage in the face of disappointment can be admirable qualities in a client-manager relationship. But sometimes a change is needed. Longtime investment counselor Claude Rosenberg offers this advice.
There is no sacrosanct time period in which to make proper manager assessments. Broad markets have varying spans of volatility, as do particular investing styles. Still, you have to decide how long to wait for the fruits of your manager selections. 3 years is widely considered to be a minimum period for proper assessment, provided, of course, that manager qualities, such as the people and their attention to their business, remain intact. Other clients recognize how short-sighted a 3-year view can be and settle for a so-called full market cycle. This is unfortunately vague. A full market cycle can be anything, including a period of much less than 3 years. Others compromise on a 3 to 5 year goal.
Throughout all the complexities of investment, whether active or passive, pursued alone or with a manager's assistance, a constant theme is the need to assess your own tolerance for risk. Former SEC Director Richard Breeden shares the lessons he learned from regulating the activities of thousands of money managers.
As we listen to what successful managers say, it becomes clear that choosing risk wisely in order to obtain higher than market returns is in many respects the name of the game. Any individual seeking greater success in the market must understand at the outset what could go wrong, as well as the theories of how to make things go right. It remains a great and enduring hallmark of the United States equities market that astute investors, or very lucky ones, can realize significant profits from successful investing. Most investors want to achieve the best return they can get without becoming part of a banquet for con men or vultures. Up to a point, selecting a professional investment manager will help meet the need for understanding and managing risk. Unfortunately, it is not a perfect solution. At the SEC, we always sought to protect investors against fraud and market manipulation, but we also protected their inalienable right to lose money in pursuit of profit.